Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We continue today in our coverage of the Santa Fe Film Festival. We've got four different filmmakers to talk to today. I'd like to welcome right now Arnold and Jakob Pander. They are director and writers of the film Selfless, which was the winner of four awards at the Bend Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's a great name for a movie, Selfless, a movie about identity theft. Identity theft. So this is something that a lot of people talk about. I've never seen it represented in the movies before. Did you draw on real life stories in order to write this movie?
Well, a bit. I mean, ultimately, kind of the seed idea for it was more of a psychological tale to kind of create the concept of what if somebody's ego and identity were so kind of intertwined and wrapped up in if their identity was stolen. You know, would their sense of self begin to collapse?
And that's the thing that's so cool about this movie is that identity works on many levels. It's not just your social security number. It's that sense of who you are, your career, your girlfriend, your house, all that stuff, and when it starts to fall apart.
Yeah, I mean, in a contemporary world, I mean, we're definitely, we're thinking a lot about who we are, how we're perceived, our career, and the idea that, you know, someone might come along and go, hey, I think I'd prefer to be you, you know, that's sort of a deep, not just a fear, but a potential reality. And we sort of took it a step further by having that sort of sense of identity that Jakob's talking about kind of permeate throughout all the characters. But obviously focusing on our central protagonist, Dylan, who's this architect who's got the job of a lifetime and essentially, unbeknownst to him, this is all happening behind his back, and slowly things just start going wrong. And before he knows it, it's like it's all collapsed, and he has to try to, get a sense of who he truly is.
And, it starts with somebody who he antagonizes really through no fault of his own and inadvertently gets really mad. And it's a funny thing, both in real life and in crime movies, where the villain really blames the victim for whatever went
wrong.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, as far as real life is concerned, I mean, the opening scene of the film, which is kind of the hook, actually, not exactly, but elements of it happen to our father, who's an artist, and goes out and,
makes a sketch of somebody, and the person gets mad.
Exactly.
Really?
And this actually happened to our father in a different setting. It was actually at a kind of like
a rodeo,
a big rodeo in Oregon, and this cowboy didn't find it amusing that he was being drawn. So it was again, sort of innocent, yet at the same time, here's a guy who's basically catching someone at the wrong time, at the wrong moment. And it obviously, turns on him. So, yeah.
What do you think you're doing? With your book there, you're staring at me like I'm some kind of freak, I can tell.
No, I'm just drawing people.
You drawing me? Give it here.
Hey, take it easy.
Give me the damn picture.
Look, I'm not just going to give you the drawing.
So help me God, you tear out that picture and you give it to me.
Okay, fine, relax.
Now.
Now, you have in the movie a pretty small cast. The protagonist, played by Josh Rengert, is a brand new actor.
Yeah. Well, for us, actually, one of the most important things early on, because this is our first feature film, and just in watching, a lot of other indie films and, even films that are being made around Portland, the thing that really stood out to us is, acting can tip the quality of the film very quickly in a positive or negative direction, and it was really important to us to get really high-quality actors. And we were able to bring on board a casting director, Lana Banker, who does a lot of Gus Van Sant's casting in Portland. And she read the script and loved it, and so immediately got on board and helped us kind of find some of the cream of the crop in Portland. And Josh Ringert was one of them. And he's actually a relative newcomer even to acting. He started, I think, a couple of years ago, but he's just a complete natural. And
you'd never know if he was a newcomer.
And so when we cast him, I think he was the second guy we looked at. And he wasn't necessarily the type that we were kind of thinking about, but there was this quality of charisma and vulnerability that he had that immediately made us think, my God, can you imagine this guy going through, you know, our story? It will be, you know, you won't want to take your eyes off of him.
And it's not that he's sort of handsome or charismatic or manly mm-hmm. man or anything like that. It's a different quality.
Yeah.
He's sort of the modern man, and we wanted that quality. And he, on one hand, he's this guy who, seems very charismatic, sympathetic, but then he keeps doing things that are like, wait a second, I don't know how I feel about that. So because he is sort of self-absorbed, and he is, kind of a selfish individual, and that's what kind of plays into the title a little bit. So, we lucked out with him, and as well, people like October Moore, Jen Hong, who's also a newcomer, playing the part of two people, of twins. And then Mo Gallini, of course, who we did actually want to, seek some sort of, Hollywood name, someone who would be at least visually recognizable. And Mo Gallini sent us a tape and just blew us away with his performance. So
we're talking about the film Selfless, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival on Thursday tonight and Saturday. At the Santa Fe Film Center. We'll be giving more details about that later. Mo Gallini plays a villain who, it's funny to, when you think about villains, some of them, have a little essential quality of humanity in them somewhere. Not this guy. This guy is pure evil.
Yeah. Well, he's, I think we were talking about a little earlier, he's really someone who, has tried to go legit, obviously has a shady past, which is implied in the beginning. And, something kind of clicks and things kind of go wrong in his world. And he's like, that's it. I'm going back to what I know, which is being an extremely dangerous criminal and very cunning as well. And so, our character, Dylan, really comes into contact with this guy, has no idea what he's, the kind
like
of hornet's nest
coming at him. Yeah.
Exactly. But Mo, we should mention, did win Best Supporting Actor at the Bend Film Festival, and so we're really excited about that because it was his first award in mm-hmm. his career.
And we're flying him out, so he'll be here at the festival for both screenings of Selfless. So
he'll be available at the Q&A.
Now, both of you have come from the world of comic books, graphic novels, mm-hmm. animation. And there is actually a wonderful animated sequence in this movie where the actor is still there, but he's walking when he's in a... We don't want to give away too much of the movie, but he's in a state. He goes right. into this sort of other world. How did the comic book world lead into the movie world, or what's the relationship between those two for you guys?
We were making short films in high school before we even got into the comic book world, although we were doing comic books in high school too. But we had an amazing opportunity happened at a very young age to get a national publishing gig, and we did a comic book called Grendel, which came out in, I think, 1986. Yeah. Sorry to date.
At a young age we were given this opportunity, so we just took advantage of it, and really it allowed us to explore our
visual storytelling.
Yeah, our ambitious ideas in storytelling and make our mistakes, and so that we felt more confident. Once we got to the place where we were, ready to take on a feature.
But making films is something that we've wanted to do, all along. And so, at a certain point, we were just like, let's bite the bullet. And we knew that, we couldn't make a movie without having a screenplay. So around the year 2000, we started really focusing heavily on writing screenplays. And Selfless is our third screenplay. And we actually, wrote it with the intention to just self-produce it in Portland, and so, that's...
Is that what you did?
Yeah, more or less. I mean,
it looks like it's indistinguishable from a large budget movie, mm-hmm. and it can't have been really that large budget a movie. No. How do you independently produce a movie like this?
Well, it's interesting because having wanting to do this for quite a long time, you know, what we were able to do in Portland was develop a lot of really strong relationships over the years with some of the most talented crews, and there's actually a lot of very talented filmmakers and film crews in Portland, so we knew that eventually we'd be able to pull them on board. And then, you know, also focusing on writing as strong a script as we could, and then essentially cobbling together, like any other filmmaker would, a bunch of, you know, a small group of people that supported us and came on board as like a limited partnership situation.
Yeah, I mean, the people who are sort of our initial investors, I mean, they were people that, you know, were in our sort of inner circle or friends of family. You know, you just had to sort of, you know, before you get to the begging part, you have to kind of find the people that you know are supporting your vision. But the other side of that is that you have to really come up to the plate, and I think we felt that pressure that we had to deliver on the goods. And so we really, you know, be it the casting, be it the cinematography, the soundtrack, we really tried to find the most talented people we could get, you know, obviously with limited resources. So it was really trying to be on top of every aspect of it so that it would be seamless and that hopefully we could accomplish something that's, you know, going to stand out and be competitive.
Well, I was utterly exhausted after watching it, the way one is after thrillers that you completely suspend disbelief, and there
Great.
You are. I mean, I was watching it at home on my couch just like, but it made me think about, because when you're the viewer watching it, you don't necessarily watch how it's crafted because you're so much in the dream of it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What is it craft-wise that you do to make a film scary?
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is I think we didn't even expect it to be nearly as much of a nail biter as it turned out to be.
I think that there are certain formulas, I guess you could say that you can implement to create dramatic effect. And also, it's what you don't show; it's what you hold back on. You know, a lot of what we shot, we got some incredible performances that we let go of or that we cut out to just keep that tension rising, to keep that it's like the slingshot being pulled back, you know, and then bam, release. And so we really tried to be mindful of how we were utilizing the footage. And so really it did sort of take a leap from, say, the screenplay to the shooting to the editing. And that's where we really found our movie. And then combined with this very chilling soundtrack by Auditory Sculpture, who is, you know, extremely talented and gifted composer. So we just, you know, we thought, you know what, let's make this gripping as possible. So it's great to hear that you were exhausted.
Well, I mean, you must have gotten that reaction from audiences that you've shown it to. This has been in the festival circuit for a while.
Well, it's actually pretty much kind of just starting its festival life. We showed at Bend, I think, in October.
Yeah.
And
very few people have seen it.
We showed in Portland just recently, which was kind of a hometown screening, and that was, you know, people standing in the aisles. So, you know, it's gotten an incredibly good response from audiences, which, of course, has been thrilling to see. Yeah.
Do Portland people recognize their city? Is it a sense of home in there?
Well, what's interesting about that, and that actually kind of gets into the whole architecture side of things, because the film is about a young, ambitious architect. In Portland, I mean, a lot of the films that have been made in Portland, and especially through films like Gus, he's kind of really captured the kind of the old industrial, moody brick and rain. And what we wanted to do was just completely shift the orientation to a lot of the modern kind of green architecture that's happening. And there's an area in Portland called the Pearl District that's completely built up over the last 10 years that's just glass and steel and super innovative kind of green architecture. And so what we did was we just focused in on that, and our kind of our creative visual mandate was no bricks in the film.
And that's so true. There's a lot of glass and steel.
Yeah, and so it's this kind of cool, minimal architecture that kind of reflects the character himself.
It's sort of like he's living in his bubble.
Yeah.
Right, and then one red couch.
And one red couch.
Which is sort of the intrusive element. You
right.
Know,
yeah,
the
it's not cool blue. But people that have seen it are really, people in Portland saw it, that love that kind of, this fresh kind of visual take on the city. So it's been fun.
The film Selfless is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival at 4:15 today at the Santa Fe Film Center, which is a wonderful place to watch movies because it's full of couches instead of chairs. And then again at the Film Center at 9:15 on Saturday evening. And you also have on Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, well, from noon to 3, a signing of your graphic novel.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
At True Believers Comic Store. And that is essentially, yeah, an opportunity to get some of our sort of rare graphic novels. We're going to have Grendel on hand.
And Grendel, we just, our latest graphic novel called Accelerate, we'll have a bunch of those. And it's just a great, you know, we'd love to meet people. We'll be there for 3 hours and, you know, would love
come
to.
Come on by and check out some comic books and, you know, we can and hang out. Yeah.
Arnold and Jakob Pander are artists who and filmmakers. Their film is called Selfless. You can find out more about it at selflessthemovie.com. And the True Believers Comics and Gallery store is at 801 B. Cerrillos Road, and you can call them for more information at 992-TRUE. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR.
The Santa Fe Art Institute is pleased to welcome world-renowned artist, architect, and filmmaker Alfredo Jarre. Born in Chile in 1956, Jarre now lives in New York, and his work has been shown extensively around the world. On December 8th at 6 p.m. in Tipton Hall, Jarre speaks as part of SFAI's 2008 season of visiting artists. More information at 424-5050 or sfai.org. This message sponsored by the tax-exempt Santa Fe Art Institute.
I'd like now to welcome Lucia Duncan and Jennifer Winter. They are director. Lucia is the director and producer, and Jennifer Winter is the executive producer of the short film that is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival, Tribute to Eliseo Medina. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Lucia, who is Eliseo Medina?
Eliseo Medina is an executive vice president of SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which is the largest and fastest growing union in the U.S. that represents healthcare workers, property services workers, which are janitors, security officers, and also represents public sector workers.
And how did he start as a labor organizer?
Eliseo immigrated to the U.S. with his family from Zacatecas, Mexico, when he was about 10 years old. He grew up then in Delano, California, working as a grape picker with his family. He left school when he was a child to start working and help out with the family's income. And he was organized by Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers Union.
What were his methods? Jennifer Winter, maybe you could address this. How did he achieve such amazing success, starting with so little as a labor organizer?
Well, I think part of the reason why he achieved such major success is because of who he was and really where he came from. He, you know, like many of the workers that our union represents and many of the workers that he interacts with, he came from the trenches. He experienced what a lot of workers that unions represent have gone through throughout history and still continue to go through today. So I think he can really speak to what our membership experiences, because he's experienced it. He went through the same struggle himself. I think also a large part of his success has to do with his skills as an organizer and his personality and demeanor as a person. If you ever meet Eliseo Medina, he has this real authenticity to him. Everyone that I know Lucia talked to when she was researching her film, and everyone that knows him at the union knows that when he meets you, he's really interested in you. He's really not so much telling you his story, but he's really trying to bring out your story, and you know, he carries this this trait of authenticity, of gracious humility, and this capacity to also really bring out people's skills and people's leadership. He carries that into his work, and I think that's been a major contribution to his success as a union organizer.
What are some of these successes as a union organizer, Lucia, that you document in the film?
Well, he was a successful organizer for the United Farm Workers. He led the Chicago Great Boycott. And then he went on.
So he was really in the tradition of Cesar Chavez.
Yes. He was very influenced by Cesar Chavez's tactics. So later, when he worked for SEIU, he was familiar with the kind of grassroots organizing that that has helped the labor movement so much, and has looked to including people that hadn't traditionally been in labor unions. So he's brought in people from new regions of the country. Right now, he's responsible for the organizing in the south, southwest of the U.S., and organizing industries that haven't been union before, like janitors and security officers. And those are industries that are largely made up of immigrant workers, so bringing immigrant workers into the union movement.
And immigrant workers being really the most vulnerable workers in society in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. And where the labor movement in the past may have not been as inclusive of immigrant workers, seeing them as a threat. In recent history, the union movement has grown tremendously because of immigrant membership.
One thing, Jennifer Winter, that I noticed while watching the film was something that really is not talked about much in the media. In fact, often we see its opposite, and that is the unity between Black and Latino workers. Tell us more about this and about these groups really coming together.
Well, I think it was definitely alluded to in the film, and I think that's what Eliseo has come to represent, and that's also what we as a union have been definitely moving towards. I think, as Lucia mentioned, SEIU and LSAO really strive to go into unexplored regions where unions really haven't, or where working people really haven't had a voice through unionization. And immigrant workers are becoming increasingly so a larger segment of, working people in the society. Historically, African Americans have largely been, over the years, been unionized. And I think what SEIU and LSAO have done is really, over the recent years, really brought these two communities together. I think we really see that. I really witnessed that in a organizing campaign that's featured in the video, which is the University of Miami organizing campaign. The janitors at the University of Miami, the janitor population was largely Latino, but when LSAO was down there, when we were down there documenting it, you saw this widespread support from historically African American community organizations. You saw widespread support for these largely Latino workers from labor coalitions. And I wouldn't say it's unprecedented, but I think seeing such large scale report is it support cross cultural support. A new type of support from unions is really a good sign of where we're going in terms of, I think, black-brown coalitions.
Lucia, you made this film as a tribute to Eliseo Medina on the, 40th anniversary of his work as a union organizer.
Right. It was a surprise to him. It was a tribute that he didn't know about until it was shown. He said that we were all fired. He doesn't like a lot of personal attention. It was made partly to introduce him to union members in the southwest region of the U.S. and his story. But it's interesting to watch the film today, I think, after the recent presidential elections, because of all the talk about the importance of grassroots organizing in that campaign that also draws from the farm workers movement, and to see how this grassroots organizing has engaged a broader population, broader groups of people in the U.S. in political campaigns. So I think it's a fitting time to watch this movement and to be inspired by the types of change that are possible when people come together and unite to fight for better working conditions.
Lucia Duncan is the director and producer. Jennifer Winter is the executive producer of the film Tribute to Eliseo Medina. It's a short film, 17 minutes, and it screens with Our Spirits Don't Speak English, Indian Boarding School at the New Mexico Film Museum, today at 12:45 in the afternoon, and then on Saturday at 5:45 in the afternoon. Thank you so much, Lucia and Jennifer, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by ABQ Ride, the City of Albuquerque Transit Department. ABQ Ride provides connecting bus service for Santa Feans coming into Albuquerque on the Rail Runner Express. The City of Albuquerque and ABQ Ride welcome you to the Duke City. Learn how to plan your ride online by visiting cabq.gov/abqride. Visit downtown, Old Town, Knob Hill, and Uptown. Find your connecting bus online at cabq.gov/abqride and click Plan Your Ride.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Upaya Zen Center. From Wednesday, January 7th to Sunday, February 1st, Upaya hosts their winter practice period on science and selflessness with notable teachers from the neuroscience, mind, and life communities. Also, Sensei Kazuaki Tanahashi returns with Zen painting and calligraphy, and each Wednesday evening a thoughtful and reflective Dharma talk. More info at 986-8518 or upaya.org. That's upaya.org.
I'd like now to welcome Ruby Yang. She is joining us by telephone from China, and she is the director of the film Tang Zhi in Love, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Ruby.
Thank you for having me.
This is a film about gay men in Beijing, China. How did you come to make this film?
Both Tom and I were working on AIDS awareness campaign in China, and we have talked to a lot of gay men, especially the married gay men, and we find that they, because under family pressure and traditional value, a lot of them cannot come out, and they have to get married to a child under family pressure. And under that situation is very dangerous for AIDS, spreading AIDS, because, the secrecy around their life, they cannot even tell their own wives that they are gay. And meanwhile, China is increasingly open, sexually open, and a lot of them have one-night stand, and they went to bathhouses. And so that's really a new phenomenon in the past, I'd say, 5 years. And I was very intrigued sort of by their story, and a lot of them have many, sort of very much torn between their own lives and care for the family. So that intrigued me to do the film on the gay man.
What happens to a gay man if he's actually exposed, if his gay identity is revealed, whether or not he's married in China? Is he ostracized? Does he have a hard time?
Exposed is sometimes it's very complicated. They really live under secrecy. They live on the internet with pseudo identity. They don't really reveal their identity, and when they went to bathhouses or have finding sexual partner, it may not necessarily really using their own name. So that's, most of them don't have a chance of, have their identity exposed. But some of them, do have, hi.
Yes, go ahead.
So, but if they get exposed, I would say, they're not ostracized, but people just, discriminate them at work and sometimes by their friends.
We're also being joined by telephone by producer of Tang Zhi in Love, Tom Lennon. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
It's great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
Nice to be there.
So,
linked across the world.
Very much so. We're talking New York, Santa Fe, and one of the provinces in China right now.
In Anhui province, right, Ruby? Is that where you are?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's interesting. The men, the mostly young men that you have in this film are really caught in this problem of on the one hand, loyalty to their families and trying to fulfill the duties and expectations of a Chinese man, and on the other hand, being true to themselves. How did they feel about making the film? What were they frightened in any way?
No, not frightened. I mean, otherwise they would not tell the story. They want their story to be told. So that's why when we got find these young two young guys on the internet, and we post a little posting on the gay website, Young for Young Gay Men, and actually five or six people reply, and they want to be on television. At that time, you know, we told them, what about having you guys on CCTV, which is the Chinese television? Some of them said yes.
So what is it like?
At the same time, you know, there's a kind of split impulse there, because on the one hand, understandably, there's this huge burden. And when you have that kind of burden of secrecy, it's just natural that you're impelled to unburden and open up and talk about it. At the same time, Ruby has come under quite a bit of pressure of anxiety after the fact of people who talked on camera saying, you know, well, are we sure? Or the people who love those and are friends with those people saying, you know, are you sure this is not going to leak back? Are you sure my parents aren't going to see it and so forth? So there is an ambivalence. On the one hand, you want to talk, and on the other hand, yeah, there's obviously a big investment in maintaining that which is secret, remaining secret.
The film Tong Zhi in Love won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Short Subject in 2007. The film has been shown worldwide, I believe. What about in China? Has it been shown much there?
I have to correct. You mean the Blood of Yingzhou District,
Just to jump in, there's two different films. The Blood of Yingzhou District, the short film about AIDS orphans, has been fairly widely seen and won the Academy Award, as you mentioned.
Oh, okay.
Tong Zhi in Love is just out and has been seen very, very little. And we're hoping that it might get some attention from the Academy, but nothing like that has happened.
Okay. Sorry for my error there. But nevertheless, so this film has barely been seen anywhere, much less in China.
Yeah, that's right. It has shown in a couple of film festivals in the U.S. and in the central, in the mountain, you guys are premiering the film. area, which is...
Is there a political movement for gay liberation in China at this point?
There is this lady who a couple years ago tried to have a legislation passed in the People's Congress about legalizing gay marriage, but she's no longer a vocal in the last 2 years, but she still published stuff on the internet. So I think China is opening up, but it takes a long time.
To the extent that there is a movement in China, and I think movement might be too strong a term, gays in China and Asia wide have been very clear about saying that the U.S. sort of political style, more confrontational model is not the road that they want to go down. I think there's an understanding that first of all, wouldn't work, but I think there's also a feeling that there are particular cultural qualities to a gay movement towards freedom in Asia that is not going to, you're not going to see people, you know, as we remember from the darkest years of the AIDS crisis in the U.S. where people were chaining themselves to the White House. You know, nothing like that is going to happen in China for obvious reasons, but including some less obvious ones, such as the cultural disinclination to that kind of really in-your-face confrontation.
We're talking about the film Tong Zhi in Love. So you show in the film that some of these men marry lesbians. What is the lesbian community like? I mean, it's not covered in the film, but do gay women face the same kinds of problems?
They were planning or thinking about marrying a lesbian. We didn't do much research on the lesbian scene, but the lesbian faced less pressure. That's what we were told. And because it's more acceptable to have women not getting married remain single, and it's very in China for having women live together as partners are not unusual. So they face less pressure, much less pressure.
Is AIDS and HIV a big problem in China?
Not as big, of course, not as big as in Africa, but now it used to be just the AIDS was spread by a blood transfusion and also by drug use, but now the sexual transmission has increased, and in fact, close to half of the newly transmitted HIV transmission through sexual transmission. And the total number of infection or numbers are about 650,000 in China. That's not a very high number.
Ruby and I got involved with our work started out, and we still stayed very involved in the AIDS issue in China, and that's really been our work for the last 4 or 5 years in China. And this film started out as part of that research. The gay population in China has a much, much, much higher infection rate, really scarily much higher infection rate than the population at large in China. And we felt that we should start exploring that issue, and Ruby spent a lot of time talking to gay men, trying to get people to go on camera and talk about it. But one of the kind of mysteries of documentary film is sometimes you end up doing something very, very different from what you start out intending to do. And the intention was to make a film about AIDS. There is not in the final film a single reference to the disease. It just happened to be the door that led us to that story.
Tongji in Love is a beautiful and very moving 30-minute film that is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival at 4:30 tomorrow, Friday, December 5th, and once again at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, December 7th. It screens with the feature film Arusi, Persian Wedding, at the DeVargas 3 Theater. Ruby Young is the director, and Tom Lennon is the producer of the film. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR.
Programming on KSFR is underwritten in part by SF Jazz, the San Francisco-based nonprofit presenter of jazz music and education programs, supporting America's unique art form wherever it flourishes. The New York Times calls SF Jazz something New Yorkers could get jealous about. To find out more about SF Jazz concerts and programs, visit sfjazz.org.
Join the New Mexico Filmmakers Intensive for an open house Thursday, December 4th at 6 p.m. RSVP for details by calling 473-6413 or sending an email to info@filmmakersintensive.com. Apply now for NMFI's 2009 one-year immersions in screenwriting, producing, directing, and editing starting in January. Enrollment is limited, and New Mexico residents are eligible for tuition assistance. This message underwritten by the College of Santa Fe, a nonprofit organization.
I'd like now to introduce Dennis Yaris. He wrote the screenplay for the film Jolene, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is a story based on a story by E.L. Doctorow.
That's correct.
How different is it? I have not read the Doctorow story.
Well, the short story was part of a series of five stories that he published in 2004 called Sweetland Stories, five real American stories, and each about 25, 30 pages long. So really in the adaptation it was to further develop the characters that he created.
Well, I mean, short stories. This movie is an epic. It feels like Gone with the Wind. It feels like you've lived a whole lifetime yourself while watching it.
Cinematically, what makes it unique is as this young girl at 15, when we watch her mature over a 10-year period, and she migrates from South Carolina to Phoenix, Arizona, to Las Vegas, Nevada, to Tulsa, to Los Angeles, you have about every 20 minutes virtually a new cast. And she's the thread through it.
That's right.
So, in essence, it's really five films in one. So you're right. It does reach epic proportions because of that.
Now, Jolene is a wonderful character played beautifully by Jessica Chastain, who I guess is a fairly new actress.
She is a new actress. This is her introduction role, Juilliard graduate. She was on stage in Los Angeles opposite Al Pacino, where she was discovered by a casting director named Mary Verneuil, who does primarily Oliver Stone's and Quentin Tarantino's movies. Since Jolene, she has a lead opposite Al Pacino. She just finished the Terrence Malick film opposite Brad Pitt and Sean Penn, and she just completed another film opposite Helen Mirren. So,
very charismatic actress.
Absolutely.
Beautiful redhead, very, very spirited. I mean, she starts out playing this, she starts out as in the film Jolene, 15-year-old girl who marries. The marriage goes wrong, and she has a series of lovers and husbands along the way. And I suppose you could say it's kind of a tale whose moral is don't hitch your wagon to any dude.
Well, in a sense, and the thing that makes her intoxicating and the role successful is that she doesn't induce any of those relationships. In fact, as she matures, she actually resists them.
That's right, but not very successfully.
Not successfully, that's right. But remaining eternally optimistic, nevertheless.
Now, Jolene, it's weird. When it started, it felt to me like it was almost set in the 1950s, but it's set in the present, kind of.
It is. I mean, really, the 10 years we see the maturation of this character really is, say, 1996 to 2006, that period of time.
But did you write it to have a kind of more old-fashioned feeling to it?
I think the roots of it were there because it really is an in-the-trenches American story, and we cover the entire spectrum from, say, a very simplistic sort of environment that where we were first introduced to her to a very almost futuristic environment, meaning that there's a sense of modernity that evolves with her maturity.
We don't want to give away too much of the movie, which is always the trick with talking about narrative films. But tell us, first of all, how did you come to write this, and then what was your role in getting the film made into a finished film?
Well, actually, I didn't have any role in becoming a finished film. I just did simply the adaptation for one of America's greatest authors, who at 75 years old or 74 years old wrote a very provocative, engaging film that to me is highly contemporary. And it was really an honor to be able to take his roots and then create this, I guess, dialogue that the short story itself had only about 20 lines of dialogue. The film has over 1,000 lines of dialogue.
Right.
Some segments of the short story were 1 to 2 pages long that became 20 minutes of film. And it was, fortunately, the only screenplay ever approved. Films such as Ragtime, Billy
Bathgate.
Approved
by whom?
By the author himself.
Really?
Yes.
Has he seen it?
He has. Yeah, he's incredibly pleased with the results. The first time in his career.
Very interesting. And that's a I never really thought about it before. An author to have an unapproved... Are you even allowed to do that? To take the short story of somebody and make it into a film without their approval?
No, not only can you do it, but he must approve the writer with his stature. And the thing that I think really sold it for him is I elected to make Jolene the narrator.
Right.
And by doing so, in some of the voiceovers, I could use word for word what he had written. So there's not anything better as far as a tribute to the original author than to be able to utilize his exact words.
So did you... Were you already working with directors and actors and things like that when you started writing this screenplay?
No, none whatsoever. No, it was really the adaptation I did just really almost on spec.
And so what happened from there?
It just quickly materialized. I mean, there were many actors actually vying for these roles, and it was kind of remarkable because typically a lead actor might have a 6, 8, 12-week stay in fulfilling the role. Here, because of the segmented way that this movie transpires, each actor was really in for 1 or 2 weeks. And so they gave 110%. It's almost like a pugilist who fights amateur and gives it all in 3 rounds rather than a professional that has to go the 12 rounds. So they gave all, I mean, tremendous efforts in their roles.
What were you doing? You wrote the screenplay. Where were you during the filming? Were you around?
I was around most of the time. This particular director, Dan Ireland, who did a remarkable job, in my opinion, wanted me there. And we had little conversations prior to each day shooting and really just kind of had the root of the screenplay take on a bit different form as we spoke it through or talked it out. So it was really a collaboration. A really intense collaboration in this case.
When you have a finished script and then you've got actors, the caliber that you have in this film, very, very good actors from beginning to end, especially Jessica Chastain, who plays Jolene, do they ever say, oh, I'd rather say it this way? I mean, does the script evolve a little bit during the shooting?
It does, and I'm grateful for that. Because the way something is written opposed to the way it's going to be delivered are two different things. And so, yes, that was on a daily basis. And that was so good being there. I mean, the actors really contributed to this text.
So Jolene is being screened tomorrow night, Friday, at 6 o'clock at the DeVargas One Theater. It's part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Dennis Yaris is the screenplay writer for Jolene. Is the director going to be around?
He's not going to be in able to come to this screening.
Or any of the actors?
That I don't know. I don't know. Perhaps.
Well, we shall see. But it's a gala screening. It's part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. And Dennis, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Okay. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thank you so much to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for doing a wonderful job today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, baritone saxophonist Pepper Adams. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, we wrap up our coverage of the Santa Fe Film Festival, and the wonderful Giancarlo Esposito, who has been in many of Spike Lee's films, is going to be with us live at the Santa Fe Baking Company, and of course, Robert Knott, speaking of the arts. So that and much, much more here on KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.